We are in Berkeley, California, at the Hotel Durant on the edge of the UC Berkeley campus with UC Berkeley Professor of Psychology, Alison Gopnik. And you have a recent book out, but you have lots of other books as well, masses of things to talk about. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, Roger.
Since we did that series, The Human Quest.
That's right. Let
me just start by asking you about, and this, you have got so much stuff out there, you're major purveyor of psychology on the web out here as well as everywhere else. But I wanted to start with your latest book, The Philosophical Baby. What children's minds tell us about truth, love, and the meaning of life. The obligatory, huge, promissory note after the colon. What now, do babies?
Right. Now, I should add that, as far as I'm concerned, when everyone says the meaning of life, it's in ironic quotations, although I've discovered that that isn't necessarily the way it's always read. So my assumption is that the meaning of life always is sort of the meaning of life.
The continuation of life, maybe. But I mean, what were you doing here? Because let me context that by saying that the book before it, The Scientist in the Crib, What Early Learning Tells Us About the Mind, with Andy Meltzoff and Pat Kuhl.
Right.
Why now the shift to the baby, right, and the injection of philosophical in there? I mean,
well, from the very beginning, I actually started out my career as a philosopher, and I'm still an affiliate in the philosophy department here. And one of the really interesting things about philosophy is that you could read 2,000 years of philosophy and think that human beings reproduced by asexual cloning. There are no children in philosophy. In fact, I actually did a little analysis of the index of the 1967 Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and there are 4 references to children, parents, birth, anything in the entire 2,000 pages. Angels, lots of stuff about angels, lots of stuff about the morning star, nothing about children. And that always seems sort of peculiar to me, because if you think about a lot of the really deep philosophical questions that we want to answer, things like, how do we come to know as much as we do about the world? Or where do our moral intuitions come from? Mm-hmm. Or how is it that we manage to love other people? Or even, I think, things like what makes life meaningful and significant. If you sort of asked ordinary people answers to those questions, it would seem sort of obvious that looking at children could provide some of those answers. And in the past 30 years or so, as we've started to develop a real science of developmental psychology, it's become more and more obvious that that's one of the best ways of answering the deepest questions about the human condition and what human life is all about. And what I tried to do in the book is to take a number of these big philosophical questions. How can we find out the truth about the world? How is it that fiction and imagination can be informative to us? Why is it that when we read a novel, which of course is all, you know, made up, it's bollocks, right? It's just something that someone made up. Why does that tell us something about the world? Where are we born to have a kind of moral sense, or is it somehow something that we painfully construct? What's the nature of our personal identity? What makes me me across all the time from when I'm young to when I'm old? So the idea was to try and take some of these big philosophical questions and show how the work that I and others have done over the last 30 years in developmental psychology can actually provide us with real answers to these questions. And I guess, you know, part of my history was I started out as a philosopher, but I always rather naively, we would ask these questions and I would say, okay, good, well, so let's figure out what the answer is. And that was a little, you know, infodig for philosophy. But I think that we actually can figure out at least some of the outlines of answers, and one of the best ways to do it is to actually go and study babies and very young children.
So give me something concrete to work. Well, so let me look at this piece that you wrote for Arianna's Huffington Post here.
So
there's a line here where you say, by 18 months, babies have gone beyond empathy to genuine altruism. You talk about that. You talk about, if children are so good, if empathy and altruism are such a deeply rooted part of human nature, then why are adults so bad, and
right,
so on and so forth. So what are the kind of experimental stuff that makes you think that
right,
people at 6 months old have some sense of what's appropriate behavior?
Well, it's interesting because it doesn't seem to really cash out as being about appropriate behavior to start out with. What we know is that literally from the time babies are born, they're sensitive to facial expressions that other people have. They're sensitive to other people's emotions. And to some extent, they take on the facial expressions and emotions of other people. So there's already a sort of special link between what it feels like to be me inside and what I see when I see another person, especially a caregiver, someone I'm intimate with, that seems to start out in some primitive ways, even literally from the time that babies are born.
Let me just interject there. When I said appropriate, I didn't mean socially acceptable. I meant the some way in which even tiny, tiny, tiny tots in cribs are somehow able to evaluate responses from others and then situate their own behavior accordingly. So that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, I mean, what seems to be true is that babies have this incredible social sensitivity and social knowledge from the time they're extremely young. And interestingly, from the time that they're very little, they seem to sort of make an assumption that other things equal, they should try to help other people get what they want and not get in their way, and that other people should do the same. So there's a lovely experiment that Mike Tomasello and Felix Warnikin did recently, where, for instance, you show the baby that the experimenter has dropped a pen on the floor, or you show the baby that the experimenter has thrown a pen to the floor. And when the baby sees that the experimenter has dropped the pen and the experimenter is kind of trying to get toward it, the babies will actually crawl over many pillows and go across the room to get the pen. This is 14-month-olds, to give it to the experimenter. On the other hand, if the experimenter threw the pen away as if he didn't want it, then the babies don't do that. So the babies seem to be reading the intention of the experimenter and figuring out from that, okay, this is what he wants, and I'm going to try and help him get what he wants. In our lab, we've done experiments which show that by 18 months, babies can even take the perspective of another person when they're making those altruistic decisions. So we have this experiment with broccoli and crackers that you may remember, where the babies see the adult, 18 months old, see an adult. They have two bowls of food, one bowl of raw broccoli, one bowl of crackers. All the babies, even in Berkeley, like the crackers and don't like the broccoli. Then they see an adult who takes a little bit of food from each bowl and either makes a happy face or a disgusted face. So she either goes, broccoli, or, oh, yuck, broccoli. And then she puts out her hand and says, give me some. Now the question is, what will the baby give her? Will the baby give her what the baby likes, the crackers? Or when she says that she likes the broccoli, will the baby give her the broccoli? Mm-hmm. And what we've discovered is that 14-month-olds will just give her the crackers, although they often will take a long time to do it because they think it's really weird. But 18-month-olds will give her the broccoli if she likes the broccoli. So there's two things that are interesting about that. One of them is a very basic piece of morality, which is do something for someone that they want, give people what they want rather than what they don't. But another, even more basic piece of morality, which is, and take their perspective. Find out what it is that they want. Give them what they want, not necessarily just what you want. So these two fairly fundamental aspects of what we think are kind of necessary for our moral reasoning, our sense of empathy, our sense of trying to advance the wishes of the other person, and our sense that we also should be taking the perspective of the other person. By 18 months, both of those things we have evidence are in place in children.
All right, so just to be clear, you're not saying that they're doing this out of some innate moral sense. You're saying that they are performing actions which in this particular social setting are rewarding and become part of the scaffolding of something that we later call morality.
What I'm saying is what we later call morality is a really complicated thing, and it has lots and lots of different aspects, lots of different elements that actually constitute the very complex set of behaviors that we think of as being moral in adults.
Is it constructed? Or, I mean, there's enormous debate going on about, the moral landscape. Sam Harris has a book coming out. Right. Pat Churchland has a book on brain-based values. John Haidt, of course, has written extensively. Right. Josh Green has something coming out.
So here's what I think the developmental literature says about this, which seems consistent with what one would want to say philosophically. What the developmental literature says is that there are elements of what we think of as being moral, particularly in very close relationships, close intimate relationships, like the relationship between the caregiver and the infant, from very, very early on. So from very, very early on, babies seem to have this sense that in a close intimate relationship, that there's a kind of link, that you should care about the other person's feelings in much the same way that you would care about your own. So in a sense, something like a kind of primitive golden rule about do unto others as you would do have others do unto you, at least for an intimate, at least for someone who you're close to. That really does seem to be something that's in place very, very, very early on.
But that sort of moral training wheels would make sense, wouldn't it?
Exactly. But one of the things that I think happens, so some people have sort of suggested, you know, in the kind of evolutionary psychology camp, okay, what that means is we have an innate moral grammar, we have an innate moral sense, and everything else is just sort of window dressing. And I don't think that's true, because what you see in the babies from the very beginning is that they can recognize that we could bring about those good outcomes in different kinds of ways. So by the time they're 2.5, for instance, babies make this, young children make a distinction between the truly moral, which is things like you don't hit another person, you don't cause harm to another person, and then the fact that we might have moral conventions, things that we need to do to bring about the moral, like have a rule about, you know, not dropping your clothes on the floor. And 2- and 3-year-olds think those are moral too. It's not that they don't think that those are moral, but they recognize that that's a different kind of moral principle, following the rules that a society enforces, than other kinds of moral, kinds of moral rules, like moral rules against causing harm. So what's interesting is, in the book, I call this chapter Love and Law. It's as if they have these two elements of morality, the sort of basic, intuitive, don't cause harm to others element seems to be there from very early. But that's not all there is to morality. There's also this element about, and as a social group, make principles, design rules, design laws that will enable that to happen for the greatest number. And the children seem to have both of those in place. So they seem to have a sort of metric, which is do good, right? In the sense of don't cause harm to other people. But they also seem to recognize that that in and of itself doesn't tell you very much about the kind of complex situations in which you have to act, and that you need to also follow the conventions and rules of the society in which you find yourself. And those two, this kind of basic empathic don't cause harm, and the other principle, which is do as the people around you are doing, give you a really nice mechanism for having a kind of grounded morality, but also a morality that's revisable. So it's not like the evolutionary psychology view, mm-hmm. We got this in the Pleistocene, we're stuck with it, parts of it are rational, parts of it are irrational, but you know, we're stuck. It's a vision that says, there's a kind of a way that we have, especially an affective way, especially in close circumstance, in close personal relationships, of perceiving what we think of intuitively as being good or ill. And that's a kind of engine that lets us develop these more sophisticated ideas about rules and laws, and might end up letting us, you know, say something like, well, if a doctor is actually causing physical harm, that's okay because it's in the service of some other good. And I think this is very generally true about the picture that comes out of childhood. Again, the kind of evolutionary psychology view is, which I think is sort of a bit old-fashioned at the moment, is there's this set of constraints, there's this, you know, innate moral structure or innate knowledge, and it's unchangeable, and we're kind of stuck with it, and we can only alter it with, you know, tremendous energy and difficulty in social institutions. And I think what the developmental work is saying is that babies and young children are already, from the time they're born, revising, changing, reshaping the way that they think about the world in the case of their intuitive theories, in the light of evidence, in the case of their morality, in the light of what are the good outcomes. So they don't start out as being blank slates at all. They start out with a lot of assumptions and knowledge about the world, and including the world of values. But that's just the first step. That's the step that they also start out with, these very powerful mechanisms for revising and changing and reshaping what they think, what they feel, what they understand in the light of the new evidence of what goes on around them in the world. And I think it's that combination that gives us our uniquely human capacities.
Now, when we first started talking about issues like this, there were these possibly, apparently artificial time barriers that one heard about. So mm-hmm. that, you know, theory of mind didn't really show up till 4 years of age. This was the when you were capable of walking a mile in somebody else's neurons and taking their perspective and so on and so forth. And then you're talking about these similar sorts of skills at 18 months, 14, mm-hmm. but not 14 months, 18 months. So What has happened in the field that has shifted people's perception about this? I mean, are we invoking mirror neurons here? What kind of systems are we talking right. about?
We are definitely not invoking mirror neurons. Let me just say that as loudly and clearly as I possibly can. I did a piece for Slate where I talked about the myth of mirror neurons. And I think mirror neurons are a myth, not just in a dismissive sense, but in a technical sense. In the technical sense that what a myth is it's a lovely image that we really like and that feels to us as if it captures something important about us. So mirror neuron, it's this beautiful mellifluous word. It has this beautiful image. There's a thing that goes, you know, there's a dendrite that goes to you and a dendrite that goes to me. And you can see why people really like to think about mirror neurons. But there's no scientific reason at all, and there's lots of scientific reasons not to think that the reason why we have empathy and have this link to each other and so forth has anything to do with mirror neurons. But that's another story. What I do
well, maybe
think
maybe I should sit you down with Ramachandran one day and we're going to have a conversation about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think even the people who talk about mirror neurons, if you push them, the scientists would say, well, we don't really mean that because you have a particular cell in your brain that we can identify that that's why you have language and empathy. We mean something more general than that. But exactly what it is not terribly clear. In any case, the point here is that what's happening is that we're starting, I think the big difference between where we were 10 years ago and where we are now is that 10 years ago we could point to these kind of, here's what happens when. So we could say, here's what children are capable of doing when they're 2, here's what they understand when they're 4, here's what they understand when they're 6. Mm-hmm. And what we've started to discover in the last 10 years is actually what the mechanisms are that get them from 2 to 6. So it's a really big difference. It isn't just saying they know this at this point and they know something else at that point. It's something about what actually happens that gets them from one conception of the world to the next conception of the world. And that's a very different place in the science. I didn't think we would get there as quickly as I think we actually have. That's a very different place in the science than when we were just saying, for instance, you know, we could say before, well, you have an intuitive theory, say, of desire or preference when you're about 2, and then that turns into an intuitive theory of belief when you're about 4, and it turns into a theory of interpretation when you're about 6, and so forth. Now what I think we can say is, here's the way that the children are actually using the evidence that they see to revise and change what they think in a way that leads to what looks like a kind of rational sequence of different pictures of the world.
So this would be why you use the notion of the scientist in the crib, because this notion of revising one's hypothesis, as it were,
right.
according to evidence and empirical data coming in and so on, that you would say that baby, very young infants are doing that.
Right.
And they are therefore performing scientific acts, as it were.
Well, see, the interesting thing is when 10 years ago, even 15 years ago, when we started, I and a lot of other developmental psychologists had this idea about, well, maybe it's like scientific theory change. Where's a place that we could point to that has the qualities that are that we see in children? Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of interesting because in going all the way back to the Greeks, there's always been this tension in philosophy and psychology and developmental psychology, which is this. It looks as if we have this very abstract, hierarchical, structured, productive knowledge of the world around us. You know, I know that there are trees, there are chairs and tables, and I make all sorts of wonderful new predictions on that basis. But it also looks as if I somehow get that from the very specific, concrete senses, experiences that I have, you know, the bits of air coming in at my eardrums and the bits of photons hitting the back of my retina. And the question has always been, how could we get to this abstract knowledge of the world from a bunch of photons hitting our retinas? And the traditional answers have been either to say, well, we don't actually learn it, we just have it all there to begin with, the way Plato said, the way Chomsky said, or to say, well, it looks as if it's all abstract and sophisticated, but really it's just a whole bunch of very specific, say, connections or associations or reinforcements the way the behaviors did or the way the connections do now. And when we actually look at theory change in science, or when we look at what children are doing, neither of those pictures fit. What we seem to see in science is we have abstract structured knowledge of the world, and we go out and a bunch of photons hit our retinas, and we change in a progressive way. We end up with an abstract kind of view of the world that's better than the one that we had before. And that's exactly what we see in childhood. We see that the children start out with one theory of the mind, and at 3, and it's got, it's sort of good, but it makes some bad predictions. And then at 4, they've got a new one that's better. So 10 years ago, what we could do as developmentalists is we could say, this looks a lot like scientific theory change. That's another good example. But the trouble was, when we went to the philosophers of science and we said, OK, guys, so how does this scientific theory change work? They went back and said, we don't know. It's a big mystery to us. We think it's got paradigm shifts. And they didn't have a good account of it. Now, what's happened in the last 15 years is that in the philosophy of science, in machine learning, in developmental psychology, we've actually started to develop really good computational accounts of how it is, in fact, possible to start out with one theory, get a bunch of evidence about it, change it in the light of the new evidence, and get to a new theory. So we've actually got a good computational account, which we didn't have 15 years ago. Like all computational accounts, it's, you know, got its upsides and downsides. But we're at least in the, have a start on how it is that you could take a hypothesis, get a bunch of evidence about the hypothesis, revise and change the hypothesis in the light of the evidence, and, you know, repeat. Mm-hmm. And we think that that's what's going on with the kids. That's the best kind of model of the development that the kids are undergoing. And these things, techniques like causal graphical models and particularly Bayesian inference that have become the things that people use in machine learning, what we've been doing empirically is showing that even the youngest children, even babies, even 9-month-olds, are actually implicitly using some of the same techniques for taking evidence and using it to assess hypotheses and changing hypotheses in the light of evidence that we can see in, say, machine learning and that we can see in science.
Mm. So just to be clear, you're not talking about a theory of mind module,
mm-hmm.
or a language module, et cetera, You would, if Mark Hauser or Steve Pinker were here, you would take issue with some of the positions they have and so on and so forth. Just have you actually, I mean, you must have.
Sure.
Doesn't anybody ever give way on these things? Isn't this empirical at this point? I mean,
well, it's interesting because it is empirical. But I do think one of the interesting things that's happened is that I think a lot of the old battles, right, get very much reconstructed in the light of some of the new computational work. So, this kind of new Bayesian probabilistic models picture is not a picture that says, well, we just have, you know, associations between particular sensory events, or we just get reinforced, or whatever people used to think the empiricist models were. The new picture is we have hypotheses from the very beginning. In some ways, that's a very rich, innate starting state.
Do me a little favor and just insert in there what you're talking about when you say Bayesian.
Right, okay, right, sorry.
That's your ordinary vocabulary, but it'd be fun to have you just do what's Bayesian 101.
Right, okay. So the old debates came down to this debate about do we have hypotheses or not, and how do we test the hypotheses or not. And the real discovery, the really interesting discovery, is that a way of helping to solve that problem is to introduce the notion of probability. And I don't think we really had that notion very much in cognitive science in the right kind of way. And let me explicate this. So here's the idea. I'm a baby. I have some hypothesis about the world. I think that people have desires, let's say. And in fact, I was just meeting with my graduate students talking about a model and experiments we have about this in the morning. So I'm a baby. I start out thinking, everybody wants the same thing that I do. So, you know, if she wants something, she probably wants a cracker. That's a pretty good hypothesis. There's a lot of evidence for it. And not only that, but it's an extremely simple hypothesis, and that makes it more likely to begin with. So the baby's sitting there saying, this is really the most likely hypothesis about how people work. But the thought is, but there are these alternative hypotheses, right? It could be that maybe you and I don't want the same thing. Mm-hmm. But initially, what we think is that's extremely unlikely. It's so unlikely, it's not really even worth paying attention to. But now, let's say I'm an 18-month-old, I start noticing that sometimes, you know, I want to pull down the vase off the shelf, and mom doesn't want me to pull the vase off the shelf. And that hypothesis I have about how we want all the same things, it's not explaining this pattern of behavior very well. Mm-hmm. And gradually, as I get more and more of that evidence, the probability of that initial hypothesis is going to go down. And the probability of that alternative hypothesis, which started at being very, very unlikely, which was, oh, well, maybe we just want different things, that's starting to increase. We can show systematically that that's looking more and more likely. And what happens is that eventually you get to a point where what started out as a very unlikely hypothesis, given enough evidence, now becomes the truth. Now it becomes at least temporarily the thing that we think is the most likely hypothesis. And essentially, the Bayesian picture is this picture systematically, mathematically, of how we can do that process. We can take a hypothesis, change the probability of that hypothesis in the light of evidence, and then eventually have even something terribly unlikely, like quarks special relativity, can win out in the end, given a long iterative pattern of evidence. So that's what the kind of probabilistic models picture is. It is, we have hypotheses, we have data. What the data do is not eliminate hypotheses or prove hypotheses. All the data do is they make some hypotheses more likely than other hypotheses. And in a way, that's a picture that really combines, I think, what a lot of nativists and a lot of empiricists want. So, you know, it gives you the sense that nativists want, which is there's structure, there's hypotheses, we're really understanding things about the world and we're doing it from very early on. But it also gives you the ability to revise and change in the light of evidence, which is the thing that empiricists have wanted. So it's interesting that this new set of ideas has very much, it's very hard to sort of pigeonhole, is this East Coast or West Coast? It's a lot of the ideas, you know, the two places where this is being done the most are MIT and Berkeley. So that's a kind of nice sociological sign of the fact that this is a new set of ideas that are combining nativism and empiricism in a very, very promising way.
There was a very nice review, and this is on continuing this point. There was a very nice review, actually, on the Barnes & Noble website by A.C. Grayling, Anthony Grayling, who's a great friend of the Science Networks, of course. Mm-hmm. And he, in fact, did this, did refer to the old Jesuit saying, you know, give me the child until the age of seven and I will give you the man. How does that work with what you think?
Well, again, I think when you start having this picture about babies and young children building up hypotheses, using evidence to confirm the hypotheses, but then always having this capacity to revise, which is the picture of science, and I think actually interestingly also sort of the picture of liberal democracy. We never really quite know the truth. We never really quite know what would make a good life or a good society. But we start from where we are and we revise. That picture seems to be very, very deep in human nature. And what that means is that in some sense, of course, what you experience in the first few years of your life is going to shape what you think later on. But it doesn't shape it in an irrevocable way. So again, if you think about it as a kind of theory, the theory that you have early on, you have a particular vision of what the world is like. Let's say, give a grim case, you have a dreadful, abusive parent who treats you badly. You get lots of evidence for that. That becomes your preferred interpretation of the world. You interpret everything that you see around you in terms of that, in terms of that grim picture of human nature and human relationships. But it's still just a theory. It's still just something that's highly probable. It's not certain or deduced. And given enough counter evidence, given enough other alternatives, then we can revise that theory. We can actually end up in a different place. So what happens to you early on is very important because it sort of establishes, here's the most likely alternatives, and we interpret the world and act based on that. But the new idea would be, we can always change it. We can always change what we think, and we can always change what we do in the light of the new evidence that we have. And there are systematic ways that we do that.
Right. When you're talking about a lot of the new evidence that's emerging and so on, and although these days you read popular books as though neuroplasticity was a recent invention, of course not. The notion that the brain is plastic and is therefore constantly able to reinvent itself in a sense, and the use of technologies like fMRI and so on that show, although with some debate, what is going on and where and to what extent. I mean, these are the things I assume that have also produced a shift in the way people are thinking about this as well.
Well, I think certainly the neuroscience, essentially what's happened, I think this is a fair statement, everything, sort of every time there's a new discovery, it turns out that the brain is more plastic than we thought. So, you know, we sort of used to think, oh, well, there's no, you know, there's new connections, but there's no new cells. And then it turns out that there are new cells. And we used to think certain kinds of change were only possible in critical periods. And then it turns out, no, you can induce those changes even later on. So I think it's fair to say that in general, the picture that's come out of is a little interesting because often, you know, the kind of modular picture, the idea that there's these fixed capacities that are there from the very beginning and that just, you know, chunk through and make us be the way we were in the Pleistocene, I don't think that fits what's coming out of the neuroscience very well. What the neuroscience is telling us is that it's actually a picture that is quite a bit like the picture that's coming from the empirical developmental psychology or coming from the computational work, which is this picture that says it's not a blank slate. There's lots of structure there to begin with. But there's this enormous capacity for rewiring and changing in the light of experience. And in fact, that's our great human trick. That's the thing that's our great advantage is exactly that we can change what we do so much in the light of new experience. So I think the neuroplasticity literature certainly is consistent with this. But actually, I think the best evidence for it comes from developmental psychology, from actually looking at how much capacity for change and revision in the light of evidence we see. And it's interesting because there's been a whole new methodology, in a way, that's sprung up in the last 10 years or so about how to do developmental psychology that I think is relevant to this. So again, what we used to do was sort of try and figure out, what do the kids think when they're 3? What do they think when they're 4? What do they think when they're 5? What we've started to do, and by we I mean the whole field, is to start to do experiments where what we do is give children actual evidence, give children actual data about a system that they don't know about yet, and see what kinds of conclusions do they draw. So even with infants, there's a big literature on what's called statistical learning, where you can do something like give the babies an artificial language and say, I'm going to make up a language, and here's the data you're going to get from this language. What kind of conclusions are you going to draw about this language? And what we've been doing in our lab is giving children sort of artificial worlds. They're very tiny little artificial worlds. They're little machines that light up and play music when we do some things and not others. But that's a little world that we actually control, so we can determine what kind of evidence the child will get about how this machine works, let's say. And then we can say, all right, given that evidence, what kind of conclusions would you draw about how this machine worked? So rather than just saying, here's what the kids know when, what we're starting to do is say, sort of experimentally intervene and say, if we give them this kind of data, what kind of conclusions do they draw? And how could those learning mechanisms, looking at data, drawing conclusions, actually be the engine that drives the here's what they know at 3, here's what they know at 4, here's what they know at 5.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm just thinking about this. You were one of 5 kids, right?
6.
Six. Oh, my God. So
the eldest.
The eldest of 6. So that was an interesting position to be in. One of your brothers I know is Adam Gottman, New Yorker writer. Then you've had...
Three
children.
Right.
So how much has the practical aspect of being an older sibling in 6 and then a mother of 3, how much of this gets into the lab and how much of it comes out of the lab and into your life?
Well, in terms of actually practical, as in doing things that will
insights
make me a better caregiver, the answer is zip, zip. I mean, absolutely nothing. You know, being a caregiver is like, it's like being a runner or a rower or a tennis player. You know, knowing how to do it theoretically probably makes you worse at actually doing it when you're doing it in real life. So I don't think it's made any difference in terms of the practicalities of, say, how I took care of my kids or how my kids came out or how my younger brothers and sisters came out. But it has made a difference in that, and I think it can make a difference for other people, in that it made very vivid what one sort of feels intuitively anyway, which is just how significant and important and foundational and human this process of caregiving is. Now, in some ways that sounds like, okay, that's motherhood, right? We call things motherhood when they're obvious. But I don't think it has been obvious that our capacities for having children and for caring for children are as deeply, deeply part of the human evolutionary nature. as we think, and are so in a much, much deeper way than just, well, we have to, you know, produce a new generation. So one of the things that I argue in the book is that, in fact, for example, it's this extended period of childhood that we have, this long, long period of immaturity that is exactly the thing that enables us as a species to learn and innovate and create as much as we do. So my slogan about this is that children are basically the R&D division of the human species, and we are production and marketing. So what evolution seems to have done is to give us this early period of protected immaturity, like, you know, the blue sky guys over in Google or something, where we don't have to do anything when we're 3 or 4. We just play, explore, find out, make up theories, test them, think of alternatives, test those. And then when we get to be adults, we take all that stuff that we learned when we were young, and we can actually put it to work to do all the important evolutionary work, including, and here's where the interesting trade-off comes, making sure that the next generation of brilliant boffins gets to be protected and taken care of and can do the kind of exploration that they want. And I think that's a very different kind of picture of what's going on than the kind of typical parenting picture, which is, all right, well, you have this baby, you do X, Y, and Z according to the manual, and then you'll get, you know, a baby that has all the properties that you want. That's not the picture that comes out of doing the developmental science at all. And I think in that sense, right, I mean, insofar as caregiving was the most centrally significant, important part of my life, that gave a sort of illuminating picture about that. And I think it's interesting because people do sort of intuitively, one of the reasons why I put the meaning of life in the title, and I talk about this in my last chapter, it's sort of interesting that if you think about these kind of almost beyond philosophical questions, spiritual questions like what gives life meaning, or what's something we care about more than we care about ourselves, or what's something that makes us feel that we will continue to exist even after we're gone? What makes life meaningful even though we know we have that tiny little smidgen of life on Earth? I think if you ask most ordinary people, they'd say, well, actually, my kids give my life meaning, and my kids are a way that I'm going to keep going, and I care about my kids more than I care about myself. But somehow that very ordinary, everyday intuition is not something that's made it into the philosophical or the theological literature very much. And of course, it could just be an illusion. It could just be, you know, you think your kids are important because evolution wants you to do it to pass on your genes. But I think it actually really is important. It really is meaningful. It really is something that enables human beings to do some of the other things that we think are most valuable, like learn and create and do science and do art and be imaginative and do these things that are really central to the human condition.
You actually sound like you feel like you've been taking part in a large experiment or being one of a cast in a drama of some kind to overlap in this kind of way. And without actually having a script, knowing exactly what would come out, it sounds as though you've taken from the experience of being a mother rather than imposed a view of what a mother should do.
Right, exactly. So I think, you know, science, it's always true with science that what it does is it can take something that's completely ordinary and everyday that we take for granted, and it makes you recognize how even these, you know, simple, ordinary, everyday things are deep and profound and complex and interesting. And, you know, physics tells you that table is actually much more interesting and complicated than you think. And I think developmental psychology, the main thing it does is tell you that development and caregiving is much deeper and more profound and more complicated and more interesting than you think.
Well, let me tell you why I was going on that particular tack. In talking to a lot of neuroscientists who are working in the science of educating,
right,
you pick up things, you know, we talk about the stuff about, you know, that it was the two things that you get cut out of a budget are music class or PE, and how silly that is because, you know, that's not caring and nourishing the hippocampus. You really need that working. You know, really need your dentate gyrus doing good stuff and so on and so forth. So you hear all these things. You talk about, we hear talking about this, you know, being addicted to learning, maybe getting to an allostatic position and all this technical information which could be implemented. So you almost think, well, gosh, maybe we should try this out in a pilot school and have a kind of a neuron high somewhere where you're really implementing all this sort of stuff. So that was why I was talking about in taking it and translating some of
it
into.
So I think there are.
Is there anything that you've?
Right. Yeah. I think there are some pragmatic things that we can say, especially about in the context of education. I'm not sure they're terribly groundbreaking in the sense that they're things that we sort of should have known already. So what it tells you, for instance, is that this early period, this kind of 0 to 5 period, is extremely important. That there's a great deal going on there, that that isn't just caregiving in that period, isn't just babysitting or keeping the babies alive or wiping their noses, that that's actually a really crucial period in which children are learning lots of the things that they need to learn. So in general, I think the moral of this is, if the picture is that we are providing this protected period in which all this fantastic learning and everything can take place, how good a job are we doing of actually doing that? And I think we have lots of reason to believe that we're not doing a very good job of doing that for many children in the world, and many children in, say, in the United States or the UK. In America, 20% of children are growing up in poverty. And it isn't just that they're growing up in poverty in the sense of not having income. They're growing up isolated. They're growing up with incredibly stressed parents who are trying to do 5 different jobs at once. They're growing up in a world that doesn't pay anyone, doesn't pay parents anything for caregiving, and pays the people in childcare centers almost nothing for caregiving, that where there's no central funding for that aspect of development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's lots of really strong policy implications there, but they're not implications like, here's what you should do to make your baby smarter kind of implications. They're implications about all of us need to do a better job of giving babies and young children this kind of caregiving. The other important implication, I think, is that very often when you tell people, look, there's this enormous amount of learning going on, and it's going on from the very beginning, and babies and young children are paying attention to everything going on around them. The moral that people take is, oh, well, we should have things be more like school, right? So if they're learning so much, what we should really be doing is putting them in something like school at a younger and younger age. And you can see that in something like the No Child Left Behind policies, or in the pressure from both parents and governments to, say, have reading drills in preschool, get rid of free play time, get rid of, as you say, get rid of pretend and drama classes, and just have, you know, assessed testing, kind of outcome-based learning of the sort that we would see in school earlier and earlier. And we have lots of reasons for believing scientifically that that's a real mistake, because we've got more and more evidence. And mm-hmm. we're starting to get, actually, I think, really good scientific evidence, which you never quite had before. We had intuitions, but we didn't have evidence that, for example, when kids are doing something like playing, they're actually solving these causal problems and figuring out how the world works. And that the most important thing for them to do is to figure out how other people work and what's going on inside of other people. And you know, recognizing letters is great, especially when you're 5 or 6, but it's not either as profound intellectually or as significant as figuring out what's happening with other people. So I do think there are things, a lot of things that we can say in general about how we ought to be running our society and how we ought to be running our education system, but I think it's a very different picture if you think that what our responsibility is to provide a protected space in which children can do the kind of exploration and learning that they do anyway, versus if you think there's a formula that we can figure out from psychology or neuroscience, and we have this set of goals and outcomes at one end, and then we have an algorithm for doing it at the other end, and that's really the way we should be educating children or caregiving, taking care of them.
Well, there is this awfully difficult problem to solve, which I've been talking to a lot of people about, between, on the one hand, how do you optimize and nurture the individuality of every single student, every mm-hmm. single learner, and optimize their learning capacity. At the same time, there's batches organized by date of manufacture going through the school
right.
ovens, you know, and how do you possibly cope with that? We were talking about this earlier in terms of the intersection of education and, say, sleep research.
Right.
Should all children start the school day at the same time, irrespective of age? Science would say no.
Right.
I mean, their circadian rhythm's different, it's going to shift and so on, but as Lauren Frank, no, perhaps it was Matt Walker was saying earlier today, was saying, you know, the idea of, well, so you have the parents take the first shift of kids in, the younger ones, and then a couple of hours later they take the slightly older ones into school.
Right.
And
it's
hard to imagine
yeah,
that kind of relay delivery
right.
of kids to school.
I mean, you know, my joke about this is, if you're thinking about early childhood, which is the period that I know and love the best, You know, if you were to ask me, what do we need to have a more ideal environment for very young babies and children, I'd say more mud, livestock, and relatives, right? That seems to be the secret of success with very young babies, is have, you know, lots and lots of people, have a teacher, an adult child ratio of like 7 to 1, as in 7 adults who love the baby to 1 baby, and lots of opportunities to observe things, and lots of living things all around you. And you know, the truth is, realistically, it's extremely difficult to have that kind of a setup in a contemporary society. So then the question becomes, what do you do? Well, you could at least not have the kind of radical separation between the life of work and the life of productivity and the things that we think are important and the life of caregiving and of taking care of children. And certainly the idea that caregiving of very young children is absolutely at the bottom of the pecking order, both in terms of status and significance and finance and salaries and all the rest of it, that doesn't make any sense from a scientific perspective.
I mean, do you have any thoughts about, or do you know of anybody who's had any startling and interesting thoughts about what to do with education? I mean, if you were Arnie Duncan for
right,
a week, I mean,
right.
With the, you, I, when I ran into you yesterday, you were at the Sci-Fu camp.
Right.
Google and the O'Reilly Computer Publishing Group and Nature, bringing together 300 people, smart people, right, who are all coming up with
right.
ideas. Were there anything there about education? And
well, I think one thing that we could say is that we ought to, you know, some of it is sort of no-brainers. We should have funding for universal early childhood education of some sort or another. That's a simple one. We spend in the state of California, we spend millions of dollars, not quite as much as we used to, but still an awful lot, educating people between the ages of 18 and 21. And I'm glad about it because it pays my salary, but we don't spend anything like that much on supporting the learning of people between the ages of 0 to 5. And any neuroscientist, any developmental psychologist will tell you there's, you know, orders of magnitude more learning going on in that first period than there is in that later period. So that's kind of crazy, right? I mean, we think that it makes perfect sense to educate people when they're late teenagers, and we think that it makes perfect sense to take care of people when they're old, and yet we don't have that kind of transfer of income to people when they're young, when it actually would make the most difference. So that's, I think that's a kind of straightforward thing. How we actually do that, and how you'd get the balance between individual caregivers, things, you know, I think we ought to have this sort of equivalent of a voucher system for babies. So you could decide whether you wanted to spend it on childcare, group childcare, or on a nanny, on being able to take more time off of work and be with your baby yourself, so that you had lots and lots of different kinds of options about how to handle that first 5 years. And as far as later education goes, I think there's an interesting, it's interesting because one of the things that I argue based on both the neuroscience and the development is that there's a kind of intrinsic tension built into the human program, which is this. The tension is between our ability to explore, to figure things out, to get to new places, and our ability to do the things that we do extremely well, swiftly, automatically, in an effective way. Computer scientists talk about this as the difference between exploring and exploiting. So what we need to do to explore is different from what we need to do to become an expert and to exploit. And the trouble with education is we want to do both of those things. And especially now, especially in our culture, I suspect that in the past what happened was we had this early period as preschoolers or as young babies, we could explore. Then it was very clear what the role was that we had to become expert at. Say we were going to become a chef, or we were going to become a hunter, or something like that. We learned very, very well how to accomplish those very, very, very specific skills. And we know how to do that. You do that in an apprenticeship, for example, where you're watching someone do something who's an expert and practicing yourself. What we do in school is neither of those things. So we don't provide an opportunity for very general exploration and innovation and play. And we don't make children into experts in anything either. What we do in school is teach them how to be in school. And then we end up with, you know, a lot of my wonderful Berkeley undergraduates who've learned how to be really good at being in school and not really good at doing anything else. But I do think there's a problem because there's something intrinsic, especially in an information economy where we want exploration and innovation and creativity. How do you get a balance between that, which we don't want that to just to be in the babies. We want that to be throughout our lives, but we also want our children to be expert, to learn how to actually accomplish and plan and bring things about. And I don't think we do either of those things very well. I think if we really wanted them to be experts, we would give them opportunities to actually do things. One of the things I said at SciFu, and I've said before, is imagine if we taught baseball the way we teach science, right, in schools. So what we did was we told children about baseball in the first 5 years. We had them read books about baseball. When they got to high school, we would let them throw the ball to second base over and over again. Maybe in college they could sort of reproduce famous plays from past games. And then they'd never actually play the game until they got to graduate school. And that's pretty much the way that we teach science. So if we want children to be able to actually do science, then what they should be doing is really learning how to do science with an expert coach who will tell you how to do it, not learning about all the things that you ought to be learning about science.
So you think of it as more like contradistinction between a freer exploratory way of going about things, an investigative way, and the kind of Pink Floyd, another brick in the wall, if you don't eat your meat, how can you have your pudding? Yeah, things have to be done in a certain order sort of thing.
Well, I think both of the trouble is both of those things are true, and they're really in tension. I think that's one of those, as Ira Berlin, the great philosopher, talked about these life's basic tragedies, where there are things that they're not going to go together. They're two things, they're both good, they're incompatible, and you have to figure out how to make some reasonable compromise. And in education, I think the tension between exploration, creativity, inquiry, and expertise, discipline, concentration, specialization, I think that's just a tension that we have to figure out some way of dealing with. I don't think that the way that we do it in schools works very well on either side of that tension.
Okay, but your bottom line is that an infant is, a baby is not, as William James used to have it, one
right.
blooming, buzzing confusion.
Right.
That there's in fact a lot of extremely important stuff going on there, organizational stuff, scaffolding being built and so on, that could be enhanced much more if we were had the resources to do it and knew exactly how to go about it.
I think that's right. But as I say, I think most of the engine for that is coming from inside of the babies themselves. So what we need to do is, give them a safe, secure, stable, enriched environment, structure with babies and young children, and then kind of let them loose, let them go. And they'll pick up and find the information that they need.
Remind me why you started doing philosophy in the first place. Okay. I think we had this conversation once, but how did you get into philosophy in the first place?
Well, I have this...
Because your mother...
Is a linguist.
I mean, Myra is a very famous linguist, in fact. So,
yeah.
Is this how you got into this whole business in the first place?
No.
Family?
We were in this kind of crazy... six children, its own universe kind of family that was very different from any of the other families that were around us. But when I was growing up, was before my mom was even in graduate school. So she was a mother and a student at the time that I was growing up. She actually had her career in linguistics after I was already pretty much grown up. And her great discoveries were quite a bit later on in life after she'd raised her six children. So, but we did have this very, very, very rich intellectual life that was going on all the time. And I can vividly, one always tells these creation myths about your own career, but my creation myth about my own career is that I was about 10 and there was a dramatization of Socrates' Last Days with Peter Ustinov playing Socrates. I can even remember that. And I saw it on TV and I just thought it was the most fantastic thing in the universe. This was just in spite of the sad ending, this was how I wanted to spend the rest of my life. And here's where my parents came in. My parents very typically for them. So I said, I think this is fantastic, but you're talking, you're thinking about the important things in life. This is what I want to do. So they actually gave me a copy of Plato, of Penguin Plato, with the picture of Raphael on the front. I remember this vividly. And they said, well, okay, well, why don't you read what this guy actually said? And I started reading the Phaedo, which is the great dialogue in which they talk about immortality. And, you know, like most 10-year-olds, I was kind of like in the market for a good immortality argument. That seemed like a good idea. And I started reading it, and they talk about how, you know, something has to come from something else, so there must be this other world. And as I was reading it, as the oldest sister of six children, I was thinking to myself, what about kids, right? I mean, you know, that's a way that things continue and that people pass on their knowledge. And they were invisible. There wasn't a mention. No, they just weren't there in that conversation. And I remember thinking at the time, gee, that's strange. You know, here's these people talking about these deep, important things. And it seems obvious to me that kids play a role here. And yet they're not there. So my creation myth is that that was when I sort of said to myself, you know, that's what I should do. That's what I'd want to do, is do what these fantastic, deep thinkers are doing, but also take what I'm seeing every day with my younger brothers and sisters, all this interesting stuff that's happening, and think about that the same way that they were thinking about the things that they thought about. So
Alison Gopnik wrote The Philosophical Child because she saw Peter Newton doing
yes,
The Last Day of Socrates.
Right.
All right, I get it.
Well, actually, the other creation myth that I have is that I actually went to Oxford starting out doing philosophy. So I was a philosophy undergraduate. I thought that was what I was going to do. But at the same time, Jerome Bruner, who was the great developmental psychologist, was there. And I started working with him, and I started observing very young babies, 18-month-olds, 2-year-olds. And the way Oxford works is that all of the babies and children are sort of exiled up to the north part of Oxford, as far away from the colleges as they possibly can get them. And then the colleges, especially philosophy, are all the way down at the other end of Oxford. And what I discovered was that I was spending half of my life with this community of absolutely pure, disinterested seekers after truth, and the other half of my life with these kind of spoiled, egocentric, you know, whiny, narcissistic creatures who basically needed to be taken care of all the time and were constantly thinking about themselves. And of course, the first group was the babies and the second group was the philosophers. So I thought, if I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life with one group of people rather than another, I think I'd actually rather spend it with the disinterested seekers after truth and solvers of hard problems. And those were the 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds who I was seeing up in the houses up in North Oxford.
I see from one of the reviews of the latest book, I was by Paul Bloom.
Yeah, that's right.
Whose wife, of course, is Karen Wynn, who works in child psychology, Paul at Yale. Paul had a piece out recently about moral babies.
Right, that's right.
So have you guys talked about this and had a...
Mm-hmm. In fact, he was just at SIFU, and he came out to Berkeley a little while ago. You know, again, I think if you asked Paul, he would recognize... I mean, Paul is coming from that... kind of evolutionary psychology, Pinker, you know, he was a student of Pinker's, he's still right. Sort of very much a Pinker type. And that view is this view that very strongly wants to emphasize the fact that there are things that are innate. But I think if you asked him, he would recognize that, especially in the realm of morality, that's not enough, right? So he and I would both agree that a lot of the things that are roots of our moral sense are in place very early, and maybe in place even in babies. Where we might disagree is that I think that the process of revision, of change, of recognizing that what you might think at first is moral isn't, I think that process is in place even in young children. So I don't think that process depends on, you know, having a sophisticated political or religious or scientific life. I think that process is also innate. And I think Paul probably would agree with that when in his, you know, as he was thinking through it. I think it's more a sort of balance about how much do you think that what's going on is the result of this very early initial structure, and how much do you think it's capable of revision and change and alteration in the light of new evidence. So they tend to emphasize. I think part of the trouble is, you know, the contrast cases. So if your alternative is it's a blank slate, there's nothing there to begin with, it's all just socially constructed, then I don't think anybody in psychology nowadays really believes that. So if that's what the alternative is, then Paul and I are definitely on the same side.
Right.
But if the question is, given that that's true, how much of it should you think of as this fairly constrained, innate set of principles that you can't override later on, versus how much should you think of the system as one that is capable of revision and change, then I think that's where the difference is.
I mean, do you think it's just a given that the latest and best neuroscience should be solid neuroscience, should be introduced into classrooms and teaching environments and learning environments? I mean, we have a section on the Science Network called The Science of Educating.
Right.
And I think that's a perfectly appropriate phrase.
Yeah. The problem is that there's often a big gap between what we know scientifically, not just from neuroscience, but from developmental science. And then, because what we know scientifically is that this is an incredibly complex, dynamic system, it means that knowing what kind of interventions to do doesn't necessarily just follow from the basic science. I mean, as you know, in physics, you know, we know that once you get three objects interacting, it becomes this unsolvable problem about what's going to happen. So the fact that we know, say, the basic science about climate doesn't mean that we know what the best thing to do would be to solve climate change. And that's particularly true because, of course, the best thing doesn't just involve what would be the best immediate intervention, but what's socially possible, what's economically feasible, etc. And I think it's a very good analogy to education. I can tell you, here's how a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old learns. Here's the kind of data to give them, and here's the kind of experiences to give them, the opportunities to give them, to get them to learn the best. But how do you scale that up to a teacher with 30 kids in a class who have other kinds of social problems? How do you scale that up to train that teacher? How do you scale it up to an entire culture? I think those are just much more difficult questions. And it's not obvious that our knowledge of the neuroscience or our knowledge of the developmental science is just going to provide a kind of magic bullet where we can say, yeah, this is what you should do, and then this is the outcome. Any more than our knowledge of climate science provides us with a magic bullet where we can say, you know, well, we know for sure that if we do this, it will make it better. They're big, complicated systems. And the best we can do is say, well, at least it's better to know the science than not to know the science. That's for sure, right? So it's better to do it based on the science than based on just mythology, which is the way most of education has proceeded in the past. But it's not like the science is necessarily going to have a formula or an answer. And I think a lot of what we have to do is what science does. Try something, see if it works, revise. Try something, see if it works, revise.
When he came into office at his inauguration, President Obama talked about restoring science to its rightful place.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that is?
Well, from an evolutionary perspective, knowing what things are like makes us better at actually getting along in the world. I mean, that's the reason why we have brains. I mean, in a sense, you know, you could think of the brain as the office of science and technology for the human species, right? For each of us. It's the part that actually does the calculations and figures out what's going on, and then it means that the rest of our bodies do the things that are going to be the most useful and helpful ones. So it seems like it's a no-brainer that science ought to be in there. But of course, part of what both is true both in our brains and in our science is that it's tentative. It's a matter of probabilities, not certainties. It's changeable and revisable in the light of new evidence. In fact, just in SciFu, when we were talking about this, one of the suggestions that I made is, why not have legislation that has a decision tree for revision built into it? Why not say, let's do this, and then if it comes out this way, then let's keep doing it. But if it comes out this other way, let's change our minds and do something else. So rather than sort of having this notion that science is going to dictate, here's the right way to do things, that's not the way science works. At the theoretical scientific level and at the practical level, what we need to do is do what our babies are doing, which is playing, exploring, seeing what the outcomes are, revising, changing what you think, and continuing to do more of that.
But there's a kind of vicious cycle here, isn't there? And there's a problem in that, to a certain extent at least, a large proportion of the general public seems to think that science ought to deliver certainties.
Yeah,
certitude.
That's right.
And that if you want to get a grant, if your science is lauded by the media as delivering a solution or cure, blah, 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 then you're successful. So perhaps there's some incentive for you to suggest that you've got a certainty in your lab. And as you've just said, it's not. We're not in the belief business. We're in the doubt business.
Right.
So how do you convey the...
Right.
The way in which science is actually done with keeping people interested in thinking that that kind of tentative enterprise is worth supporting.
Well, again, it's interesting because it's sort of reflected in our very, this tension is built into our very evolutionary nature and in a way even built into our brains itself, in the sense that there's a tension even internally about keeping track of all these multiple hypotheses and considering all the probabilities, and then that damn frontal lobe just gets to do one thing, right? It can't say, well, I'm going to act according to all these different probabilities and see what happens. You only get to do one thing at a time. So there's always this tension between considering hypotheses, considering probabilities, and then there's an executive, and the executive just gets to make one decision. And the only kind of solution to that is to make sure that when the executive makes that one decision, they recognize that they might have to go back and they might have to do something different. That's the thing, that's the injection of doubt that science can produce. Science, by its very nature, is about saying, here's this hypothesis, this is more likely, this is less likely, but it could all change. And I think what we've shown is that that's not just something that these weird, strange, you know, scientists do. That's built in very deeply into how human beings have managed to learn as much as they do.
So you're saying that you should get rid of the phrase flip-flopping and say revising according to circumstances.
That's right. So there's a kind of, I suspect that actually to have good generals and good executives, it may be that sociologically they have to act as if they know more than they actually do. Actually, being a parent, you have to do this too, right? So, all right, men, let's go over that hill. But we ought to be a sophisticated enough society so that we know that we don't know for sure that that's the right hill to go over, and that we recognize that we can change what it is that we're doing. And as long as we're changing it in the light of evidence, that's the basis of human rationality, and that's the basis of that lets us succeed, that lets us go out and thrive in the world.
So if you had somebody, you were just teaching a graduate class, right, seminar, knowing what you know now about this whole enterprise, what advice would you give to a young scientist?
So who's starting out in science? Well, of course, the first thing is that you should do developmental psychology, because that's overwhelmingly the most interesting and fun thing that any scientist could possibly ever do. You get to hang out with babies who are the most interesting things in the world, as opposed to, you know, rats and undergraduates who my poor colleagues have to hang out with, or, you know, dissecting brains. So that would be my first piece of advice. But the other piece of advice is that one of the great things about being a scientist is that it is one of the professions where we get to have that protected childlike play capacity for an extended period, even as adults. Now, of course, we are adults, so that means that we have deadlines to meet and goals and plans and rewards and status and all those things. We can't escape that. That's what I think of as our sort of baboon nature. So that baboonery is part of science the way it is of anything else. But the nice thing about science is that there is this side to it, which is not baboonery, which is being like an infant, a three-year-old, just being able to play, just being able to explore. And that's the really precious side of it. And what our developmental psychology tells us is that's actually the side that's most likely to actually get the results. And it can be very easy to get sort of seduced into the the business of science and the getting the bigger grant than the next guy has and publishing more papers than the next lab does, and forget about the playful, exploratory, joyful, internal side of science. And that's the only reason for doing it. If you wanted money and fame, don't become a scientist. There's lots of better ways of getting money and fame and status than that. But if you want to be able to actually keep playing all the way through your entire life and have people more or less pay you to do it, then science is a really fantastic profession from that perspective.
So you're doing developmental psychology, but that came via philosophy. You write a lot, very well according to these reviews, which is nice. Is there anything that you would rather have done? Are you a frustrated cook, or would have liked to have been a famous chef or something? Is there something else you'd have liked to have done?
I'm not sure there's something else I would have liked to have done better, but I could easily imagine that I could have been a housewife, that I could have been one of those legions of women who over the years have taken care of children, raised the next generation, provided that safe and stable and secure and rich and happy background in which children arise. Now, I think I did do that. I certainly tried to do that for my three children. But that seems to me to be such an incredibly valuable, profoundly satisfying thing to do that it's not at all, it doesn't seem crazy to me to imagine that I could have, say, 100 years ago, done that and done that in a way that was incredibly satisfying and full and rich. I say sometimes, you know, having children is the most intellectually interesting, sensually satisfying, and morally profound thing that you can ever do. It's beyond anything else on all of those dimensions, certainly beyond being a university professor or maybe even beyond being a scientist. So I do think that alternate identity, which is one that we tend not to think very highly of and doesn't end up getting Wikipedia articles and videos on the web, is actually, for me, that would have been a form of life that was deeply satisfying and that I would like to see us have more general respect and concerned for.
If I gave you a time travel token that allowed you to bring anybody from the past to your dinner table for a conversation, one person or many people, right. who would you like to have?
That's a no-brainer. David Hume. David Hume is my favorite philosopher, and as I've been doing this work about causality and causal inference, I've been going back and reading more and more of David Hume. In fact, I have a whole historical project about David Hume, a paper in Hume Studies that's just coming out. And one of the nice things about studying David Hume, you know, sometimes I have to say most great philosophers, I'm not absolutely sure that I would want to have sitting across from me at the dinner table. Newton, I don't think so. But David Hume, you really would want to have sitting across from you at the dinner table. He was incredibly smart, and he was a wonderful writer, and he was extremely funny, and he really liked women, and he had a wonderful kind of sense of ironic detachment from his own importance and significance, and he was thought that sympathy and emotion were as important in life as anything else. He would definitely be my first choice.
And if you could have got Adam Smith to come along with him.
That's right.
Who thought he was wonderful as well, of course, as you know. I've just been reading some very interesting things about the death of David Hume.
That's right.
And Boswell's visit to Hume before he died and how irritated, well, not irritated, irritated is not quite the word, devastated Boswell was
That's
to find
right.
such equanimity in Hume as he faced the end.
And Hume is one of our... He not only did he intellectually introduce the Enlightenment, and by the way, the historical piece is about showing that there could have been an influence of Buddhist philosophy on Hume's philosophy, that there's actually a historical route by which Hume could have known about Buddhist ideas when he was actually writing the treatise in 1730. It's a great story. I can tell you some other time. But the important point is that if you actually look at his temperament, he had some of those kind of virtues. You know, he was an enlightenment figure in both senses. He was an enlightened figure in the sense that he was the one who led us to our current, to the state of enlightenment, of understanding the importance of reason and so forth. But he was also an enlightened figure personally. So he was someone who, in his own life, actually exemplified the fact that you could be in a world without religion, you could be in a world without God, and you could live a life that was profound and deep and morally significant, and you could be tolerant and sensitive and have all of those features. And it was great that it drove Boswell completely nuts. You know, it was, there's a story that at Hume's funeral, someone overheard two local, you know, Edinburghans talking to one another, and one said, "Oh, what's that?" And he said, "Oh, it's the death of David Hume. He was an atheist, you know, but he was a good man."
I look forward to hearing more about this. Hume at dinner, that would be a wonderful thing to happen. Now, one final little question. What are you optimistic about?
Right. Well, I am actually sort of amazingly optimistic about the future of cognitive science in a way that I wasn't 10 or 15 years ago. So 10 or 15 years ago, if you'd asked, I would have said these battles between nativism and empiricism and how much do you think that there's innate structure versus how much you think that we're learning. I think next lifetime we're going to solve those. We're not going to solve them in my lifetime. In my lifetime, we're just going to have to keep hammering back and forth. And I have been really amazed at this computational work that I think is, again, it's not, you know, it's never the secret, but I think this interaction between the new computational probabilistic models work and the neuroscience and the developmental science is actually giving us much more progress, much more traction on these what had seemed like very intractable issues about how things like learning and qualitative conceptual change are taking place. So I'm very optimistic about that. And I'm optimistic because there are new children being born. So, you know, one of the wonderful things about that human evolutionary program is that we can actually watch ourselves going off into the future. We can actually watch the process of innovation and revision. It's not just that it happens in science. It's not just it happens in each individual person. It happens sort of across each generation. And, you know, the myth of Orpheus is that myth about the way that the past recedes from you and you turn back and you can see the past disappearing. But there's a kind of analogous one, which I think is about what happens when we have children, which is we see that next generation going on into that future that we are never actually going to be able to get to. We see them mastering these new sets of technologies that we are just barely, you know, we're just barely pigeon speakers of technologies that our children are going to have as absolutely native languages. And you can see all that happening. And we can't quite get there. So there's a certain pathos about seeing them go off into that future that we're excluded from. But there's something incredibly hopeful about that, too. Mm-hmm. You know, go back to my original sense reading the Phaedo about how could you have immortality? How could you imagine that you were going to go on, things were going to continue in a way that would be better or that would at least change? And I think every time you have a child, not even have a child yourself, watch another child be born. I'm about to become a grandmother. Every time you see that new generation, developing, you have a sense of, you sort of have to have a sense of optimism about the future.
Thanks very much, Alison. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Roger.